something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we're picking up with part two of our talk about aniconism in the history of art and religion. Aniconism, as we described in the first episode, is the demarcation of divine presence without figural representation. And that was a definition that was given in an essay that I talked about in the last episode from the journal Religion in 2017 by the Yale University art historian Millette Gaefman. And so in the last episode, we talked about some issues with defining the concept of aniconism, and we talked about some specific examples from Greek religion and from Hindu religion. And we're back today to keep exploring more on the topic. So, but if you haven't listened to the first episode, you probably really should go back and check that one out first, because that lays a lot of the groundwork for what we're talking about today.
Yeah, and I do want to remind everybody that again, this is a topic where it ultimately touches on an array of different cultures, different moments in time, different places around the world. And it's not something where you can really just, you know, boil it all down to, you know, a universal law or two concerning like why aniconism is utilized and, you know, what its values are, what its, you know, the pros or the cons, et cetera. It's going to vary from culture to culture. And likewise, a lot of our, I guess, bigger questions about it, like what does it do? What is, you know, those two are going to be elusive. You know, you're not going to really be able to come up with like one solid answer that is going to cover everything.
Though in the last episode, we did talk about some specific studies of aniconism that tried to identify some trends that, again, are probably not going to be universal. But for example, one of the papers we looked at last time was by a scholar named Haberman that looked at a sort of spectrum of iconicity in the religious significance of trees and stones in some Indian rituals. And one of the trends that was extrapolated from that, at least as Haberman argued, was that it seems especially devotional religious practices, or religious practices that put a lot of emphasis on the relationship between the person and the god, tend over time often to transform originally aniconic images, such as just unadorned rocks and trees as symbols of divine presence, into more iconic versions of themselves. So you might end up decorating those rocks and trees with clothing or with masks that have a face on them.
Yeah, I particularly like Haberman's ideas regarding what happens when you put a face on a god, you know, and he brought up like facial recognition and how, you know, that leaning into personification and anthropomorphism regarding these intangible, you know, mythic ideas, and about how, you know, ultimately it makes something more, you know, tangible for your brain to lock onto.
So I wanted to start off today with an example of an iconic religious representation that is sometimes known in scholarship as divine emptiness. And this is held up in contrast to material aniconism, where you you have an object that is the marker of divine presence, but it is in itself an object. It might be a large stone or a tree or, a big sphere or something like that, or a pillar, but it's not anthropomorphic. It's not theriomorphic, but it is still a material object. Is it possible to signal divine presence by calling attention to an empty space? At least in some cases, it is. And the first example I want to look at here is a monument on the small island known as Halki, that is spelled sometimes Chalke, sometimes Hlki. It's a small island off the coast of Rhodes in the Aegean Sea. And here I'd like to read from that essay by Millett Gaveman that I introduced in the last episode. Quote, "In the late 19th century, Friedrich Hiller von Gertringen visited the slopes of the Acropolis of the island, and as he climbed up the hill, he came across a boulder with two rock-cut seats. Upon close inspection, he noticed that each of the two seats was labeled with a divinity's name in the genitive case. The name of Zeus appears on the left, and that of Hecate on the right." And this really got the gears turning in my brain. It connects to a lot of things, including some things in Christian art that I'll mention in a second here. But this is very interesting. So there are some obvious limitations on what information we can draw from this. Like the lack of archaeological record from the site, coupled with the lack of other evidence, makes it hard to determine whether this monument was ever the object of rituals or of worship. You know, did people stand before it and bow down? But the fact that the empty stone thrones are labeled with the names of gods seems like at least pretty good evidence that this is a type of an iconic monument, if we go with the Index of Divine Presence definition. Because, of course, it, in a way, notes the potential presence of a divine power without showing them in human or in animal form. And this would be an example of empty space aniconism, because the actual icon you are imagining here is the god sitting within the throne, but they're not there. It's an empty chair. And this is by no means the only example of the empty throne as an index of divine presence. This is actually found all throughout different religions of the world. The empty throne of the Buddha in some Buddhist art. Rob, I think you've got some information on that in a minute. But there are all kinds of divine furniture, it's sometimes called in Greek religion, where this is a thing that the god will sit upon or stand upon, a footstool of the god, a throne of the god, but the god isn't in it. And a big example that came to my mind is the prepared empty throne from Christian art, which is often understood to be waiting in preparation for the second coming of Christ. So when Christ comes back, he'll sit here. This imagery seems especially common in the Eastern Orthodox Church. I was looking up some materials on this, and I found a short book published by the J.P. Getty Museum that was by Alfredo Tredigo and translated by Stephen Sartorelli. And it's writing generally about the prepared throne tradition, but with specific attention to one icon in particular that's known as the hetoimesia, which is also a general term that's applied to a lot of this artwork. I think it means like prepared throne or preparedness, something like that. But this particular icon that is being examined in this book is the back half of a two-sided icon from Athens of the 14th century that's kept in the Byzantine Museum. And there are some pretty interesting common features that you find on a lot of these prepared throne artworks from Christian history. So for one thing, Tredigo writes, quote, "Few individual icons are devoted to this subject. It is more often inserted into complex compositions, such as the Last Judgment and Sophia, the Wisdom of God." The image of the preparation of the throne, or hetoimasia, is usually found on the backs of icons of other subjects, such as the famous icon of the Virgin of Vladimir. The throne being prepared is that on which Christ will sit during the Last Judgment. Lying upon the empty throne are the cloak of Christ the Judge and a closed book. In the icon on this page, however, the book is open to a passage in the Gospel. Quote, "Come, O blessed of my Father, for I was hungry and you gave me food," which is a quote from the Gospel of Matthew. Behind the throne stands a cross. The lance and the cane with the sponge drenched in vinegar lean against it, while the crown of thorns hangs from it. On the forestep of the throne stands a vase with the nails. And so you got a lot of this this imagery that's charged imagery having to do with the passion narrative in Christianity and other visions of the Last Judgment. But I also find it interesting that this prepared throne of the Last Judgment, this empty chair that Christ will sit in, he says is often not the center of a religious work of art, but it's maybe somewhere off in the corner or on the back side of an icon. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but that seems interesting to me.
It, I was thinking it's like, okay, it sounds like it has all the aniconic paraphernalia, you know? Mm-hmm. And in a sense, it reminds me a bit of hoarding. It's like the hoarding of aniconic symbols. And I mean, you think of why do people hold on to objects and things because of their association with times and places and people, you know? So perhaps a similar energy going on there. And certainly, yeah, if you are disinclined to show a human form or a humanoid form in the art, you have all of these additional things to draw from, places that the individual was, things that interacted with the individual's history or the myths concerning them.
Yeah, that's right. But it also highlights, of course, you know, one of the things we mentioned in the last episode is that certainly within the history of Christianity, there is not a lot of strict aniconism throughout its history. There's a pretty complete blending of iconic and aniconic traditions throughout the centuries of the Christian church.
But part of this idea is that, like, this is a place where Christ is not yet, but will be. This is a time that has not occurred yet, but will occur. So it makes sense that it's unoccupied, that it's unlived in. It's like, you know, it's like the airport and the Langoliers, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So the empty throne here would seem to me to take on a special meaning in the Christian context versus, say, the Greek context, which I'll come back to in just a second, because Christianity has elements of apocalyptic eschatology, which Greek religion usually doesn't. Maybe you could find some elements of it, but it's certainly not as prominent. So in the Christian context, an empty throne prepared for Christ has a special significance, meaning like our Savior isn't here yet, and that's why everything is so bad. Everything is messed up in his absence, but he's coming back soon, and then everything will be made right. So it's actually saying something about the world, not just by pointing to the figure of Christ, but specifically by being currently empty. The current temporary absence of the throne's occupant is in itself theologically meaningful.
I was thinking about how the television series Game of Thrones leaned in either intentionally or sort of accidentally or just through, you know, cultural awareness of the trope into this by promoting at least one season of the show with just an image of the Iron Throne unoccupied.
Yes. And the emptiness of the throne actually says something about the show, like that it's very up for grabs. It's not just a symbol of the kingship, but a symbol of the sort of open potential.
Yeah. And if you lean into it the right way, the hope that someone will set upon it and set things right.
Right. But to come back to the example I started with, the empty thrones of Zeus and Hecate, one thing I wanted to mention is that it has been argued that the Christian tradition of empty throne, iconography or an iconography, is at least to some extent derived from the empty throne imagery in Greek religion before it, which brings us back to those rock cut thrones from the island of Halki. So this monument on the island raises all kinds of interesting questions about how people think of gods when they engage in religious practices. Thinking back to the first episode, if that cone of the cult of Aphrodite in Paphos indicates the presence of divine power without showing the goddess having a body, I guess it is in that case, in the case of the cone, left ambiguous whether the worshippers were picturing Aphrodite as having a body at all. Like, it's not clear what they were thinking about, or whether they thought of her as something more abstract, more disembodied, and so forth. But the empty thrones of Zeus and Hecate, they are thrones. Thrones are made for bodies to sit on, and they're basically human-sized. So you could argue that these thrones are indications of a figural representation without including the representation. They do ask you to picture Zeus and Hecate as essentially bipedal hominids. They indicate that Zeus and Hecate have butts, and the butts could sit in those thrones, but they don't show them to you. The iconicity is implied, and it happens in your imagination. And I do wonder how, in general, this would tend to change the religious experience. Is this closer to the experience of the anthropomorphic icon, just a straight-up statue of a god? Or is it closer to the non-figural symbol of divine presence, like the cone of Aphrodite? Or is it something totally different altogether?
Yeah, when you start, you know, considering the idea that it's telling you this is a place where the gods have set or will set or can set, it raises so many questions about, like, why I can't see them right now. Why am I beholding an empty throne now? Is it tied to some legacy of some story about the gods having appeared here or having set here in the past, and therefore thrones were built? Or, you know, there was a, you know, hallucinations of the gods occurred here, and therefore these things were built? Or is it the idea that sometimes the gods can be reached, and therefore this is a place prepared for them? This is a place where they can be at home.
Yeah, all really good questions. And the one I come back to is, I wonder if there is any theological significance to the current emptiness of the thrones, like you could argue there is in the Christian context, you know, that Christ is not on the world right now, so it is pointedly currently empty, but he will be coming. Is the current emptiness of the Zeus and Hecate throne at all like that?
Yeah, and then, of course, it also probably draws in questions about, like, well, okay, if this is a place for the gods, I'm assuming humans are not allowed to sit here. So, you know, there's some level perhaps of the forbidden there as well. This is a place set aside for the gods. This is not a place for humans.
Right. But of course, even though it has been argued that the Christian prepared throne tradition could be derived from the traditions in Greek art of, furniture for the Greek gods, it's clear that this is a motif that appears independently in other religions as well, like because there are empty thrones in Buddhist artwork.
That's right. There's a great deal of aniconism in early Buddhism, so prior to the first century CE, which, you know, might seem surprising, you know, to a lot of people, because when you think about Buddhism, certainly when I think about Buddhism, one of the things I think about are those various images of the Buddha, you know, all these fabulous works of art, you know, paintings and, you know, inscriptions and sculptures and, you know, various reproductions of a human form. But as Susan L. Huntington pointed out in Early Buddhist Art in the Theory of an Iconism in Art Journal in 1990, early images seem to have avoided showing depictions of the historical Buddha or Buddha Sakyamuni. This is Siddhartha Gautama, said to have lived 5th to the 4th century BCE. So instead of depicting that individual or some version of that individual in these early settings, there seemed to have been a strong emphasis instead on showing trees and wheels, stupas and thrones.
And those, of course, can be deeply tied into the story of the Buddha as well. For example, I know one of the biggest images in Buddhism, other than the Buddha himself embodied, is, say, the Bodhi tree, which it is said that the Buddha sat underneath.
Right. Yeah. And that's definitely connected also to this idea of the throne, particularly, yeah, the diamond throne or Vajrasana, the enlightenment throne of the Buddha. And this is an example of an actual empty throne that is still around. You can go and see this. It's located at a Mahabodhi temple at Bodh Gaya in India. So it is a stone slab installed beside the Bodhi tree, and this is said to be where the Buddha attained enlightenment in 500 BCE. Now, the slab itself is thought to have been built by the Emperor Asoka around 250 to 233 BCE. And the tree there, the Bodhi tree, is not the original Bodhi tree, but it is said to be an offspring of that tree. And this, the current tree is estimated to have been planted around 250 BCE. Or at least it's been said to have been planted there. So not the original tree, but it's said to be the offspring. And any way you look at it, potentially a very old tree. The sacred fig or ficus religiosa can live an estimated 900 to 1500 years, and some specimens are said to be much older. So even if this is, you know, this is not the original Bodhi tree, if it's some descendant of the Bodhi tree, it's still like a really old, really impressive tree.
Yeah.
So you can look up images of this, but the Diamond Throne is essentially this stone platform that is then decorated. Sometimes there is like this parasol there as well, and various other iconic implements. But there is no individual on the throne. There's no statue of the Buddha on the throne. And basically, we have to come back again to the idea that this is something from a particular moment in the story of the Buddha, the idea that they have achieved enlightenment, that ultimately the Buddha has moved on into nirvana and, is beyond, the limitations of the physical form in this life, etc. And so there's a lot of that in the aniconic aspects of the image.
Oh, that almost seems an inverse of the Christian prepared throne, right? Like if the empty throne of Jesus is that, well, it's empty now, but he's coming back and he'll sit in it. The empty platform here is almost like, well, he was here, but he left.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I was going to compare it to something in Christianity, I would think about the empty tomb, right?
Mm, okay.
With the stone rolled aside, the idea of being, he is not in here. He's gone on. He's moved on to other things.
A sign of what he transcended.
Right. Now, the author of this paper, I should point out, Susan L. Huntington, they argue that such aniconic images in Buddhism are, quote, not substitutes or symbols for something else, but are important emblems of Buddhist devotion in their own right. And they argue that these are not indicative of an quote-unquote aniconic period during which there were laws or pressure against the icons of the Buddha. This was apparently not the predominant interpretation prior to that 1990 paper. But I'm to understand it, Susan L. Huntington was kind of a, dare I say, an iconoclast in bringing around this new understanding. And certainly I think there've been various, findings that back this up as well. Like, it's not like there were no images of the Buddha prior to this. It was certainly a trend in depicting, the story of Buddha and various aspects of Buddhist belief, but again, a lot, I think, it seems to be tied more to that story of the Buddha. Again, like, this is an actual place in the history of the Buddha. This is a time in the history of Buddha, and this is what happened.
So it's not empty as a result of a prohibition on depiction of the Buddha, but it's empty as a result of a deliberate choice stemming from the story that it's based on.
I guess it's kind of like if you go to a museum, say it's a historic house or something, they may have, hey, here's the writing desk of this individual. Now, sometimes they might have a wax version of that, say, founding father or whatever sitting at the desk. But plenty of times you're not going to encounter that. It's just going to be, here's the desk where they sat. Imagine what that was like, if you will. So I don't think it's a particularly, lofty theological concept for us to wrap our heads around, because I think if anybody who's gone to a museum or a historic location has encountered something of this nature, it just, is inevitably not as sacred a story and sacred a figure. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray.
Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AsteproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So in looking at these examples in particular, a question that really interests me is there any difference on average for the mental experience of a religious adherent of a cult with a figural icon, like a statue of Zeus or something, versus an empty space icon, like these examples of sacred furniture, you know, the diamond throne or the empty throne of Zeus and Hecate? I was trying to see if I could find any possibly applicable scientific research here. I did find something that might tell us something interesting, though I want to be careful not to overinterpret, but we'll see if this seems at all relevant. So I did find a study from the Journal of Cognitive Psychology in 2011 by William L. Thompson, Yaling Xiao, and Stephen M. Kosselin called Dissociation Between Visual Attention and Visual Mental Imagery. And this study addressed the question, what is the difference in the brain between focused visual attention and mental imagery? In other words, what is the actual difference between seeing and imagining? And in a way, this paper is responding to some theorists who had said they're actually in many ways the same thing. And we've known for a long time that there is clearly some overlap between visual perception and mental imagery. For example, there are experiments that show that they make use of some of the same parts of the brain and compete for some of the same resources so that one can potentially be mistaken for the other and they can sometimes interfere with one another. But despite this overlap, there are also indications that visual perception and visual imagination are not exactly the same thing. There are some differences in how they usually function. And the authors here are responding to theories that mental imagery might be nothing more than a specific form of actual visual perception, of visual attention specifically. And so the article tried to demonstrate that difference and explore one of the ways that these two processes are different. So in reading them describing their experimental process, they say, quote, "In this study, we used a size manipulation to demonstrate that imagery and attention are distinct processes. We reasoned that if participants are asked to perform each function, both imagery and attention, using stimuli of two different sizes, large and small, and that stimulus size affects two functions differently, then we could conclude that imagery and attention are distinct cognitive processes. Our analyses showed that participants performed the imagery task with greater facility at large size, whereas attention was performed more easily using smaller stimuli. This finding demonstrates that imagery and attention are distinct cognitive processes." So the task involved them like trying to notice the appearance of small dots within differently sized spaces, and then the contrasting test groups there were sometimes those spaces were occupied by a shape where they were applying visual attention, and other times those spaces were occupied by something on which they were asked to project mental imagery. And what they found was that the people were better at the attention task, meaning actually looking, visual perception, when they were dealing with a smaller space, a smaller square, and they were better at the imagery task, the imagination task, when they were dealing with a larger square. So I'm not sure this tells us anything about empty space aniconism versus direct iconic representation, but it might. I mean, I wonder if this has something to do with like feelings of a sort of spatial expansiveness in how you manipulate imagined imagery versus how you would actually respond to a physical statue that's right in front of you and you're looking at it, focusing your actual visual attention on it when you're concentrating on the divine.
Yeah, I mean, I think these findings are really interesting. But yeah, I feel like you could kind of cherry pick them and apply them all over the place to some of these examples we've looked at, you know, because I'm tempted, for example, to come back to what Eckhart Tolle said about, you know, find this small piece of nature and focus on it, you know, focus your attention on this bird or, you know, or this crystal or whatever. You know, I'm thinking about the idea of using the Krishna stone and focusing on that as opposed to the mountain that is also Krishna, out of which the stone was harvested, you know, like, you know, both, I can see the value of both, you know, in sort of the largeness of a god, or a goddess, or the relatability of a god or a goddess, the, you know, at what points is it more advantageous or desired to feel a sense of like personal connection and concentration regarding a divine figure? And other times, is it better, you know, to have that sort of awe moment? Like just thinking about Buddha imagery, you know, is it better, you know, if it's one, you have the Buddhas of all size, right? You have Buddhas that are tiny little statues that you carry in your pocket. Mm-hmm. You have Buddhas that are human size. You have Buddhas that are carved out of mountains and are like titanic and awe-inspiring works to look at.
Well, I think about the ways that different sizes of the same icon are I think supposed to target people different emotions in believers. For example, the tiny crucifix that somebody wears around their neck versus the Christ the Redeemer statue in Brazil, which is gigantic. Mm-hmm. You know, I think those are supposed to create different feelings. One is a feeling of awe, you know, that you are small and that God is big and that you can kind of surrender yourself to this gigantic, awesome power with the, you know, with the big statue versus the crucifix that you wear around your neck. I often take as a sign of intimacy, like closeness with God, sometimes Christians would call the personal relationship, though that's probably not a term that everybody who wears a crucifix would use.
Yeah, this is all interesting. This will be something we'll have to hear from listeners about as well. But on the subject of mental images and visual images, I started thinking about this question what's the difference? How do you compare the two? And in looking into this, I ran across an interesting article by David Van Drunen, and it's titled "Pictures of Jesus and the Sovereignty of Divine Revelation," published in the Confessional Presbyterian in 2019.
So this is like a theological journal where like it's for people within the church discussing church matters.
Yeah, but I found it pretty relatable, though, in what they're talking about here, because they're not really like diving deep into theology here. They're ultimately asking, like, what's the difference between these two, and observing like sort of the push and pull of an iconism within this tradition.
All right.
Pointing out, quote, many traditional reform discussions of the second commandment, referring to the Ten Commandments, the idea of, you know, graven images and all, have clearly taught that it prohibits forming mental images of God as well as representing him artistically, which I found really fascinating, because so much of what we've been discussing so far is, you know, especially when we were talking about the Krishna example earlier, the idea that if you have a very aniconistic medium with which to engage with, you know, this stone that does not look like a person, then you can kind of summon whatever anthropomorphized incarnation of Krishna you want, you know? And so basically, I ended up just sort of taking the mental image portion of that for granted. Like, of course, you're going to then imagine Krishna in whichever form relates to your current circumstances, or what you are looking for most out of your religious life. Likewise, we were talking about God, images of God, when we're just asked, you know, gut reaction, what does God look like? And you end up picturing the sky god from the Sistine Chapel or from Monty Python or whatever.
Yeah, and I alluded to this in the last episode, but there's actually tons of debate among Jewish scholars about how best to interpret the second commandment. You know, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images. What exactly does that mean? What are the limits of that? I mean, I think it's clear from the historical context that one big thing was that many of the other tribes of ancient Canaan, they had religious practices that would be centered around a central cult icon. So they would have an idol that would be a statue of some kind, and their worship in some way was around that or directed toward it. And so the banning of idols was in one sense, I think you could interpret that as just a way of saying, hey, we're not like any of these other religions around us. They've all got idols, but we don't. But that's kind of interesting, because one way that the ban on graven images has been interpreted is not just like don't make idols of other gods and worship them, but also don't make idols of me, the God who is speaking this commandment to you. I do not want to be represented in an animal form, say as a golden calf.
Yeah. So I was kind of surprised when we reached the level where some people take it to the next phase and say, do not form a mental image of the God in question.
Right. Don't even do it in your head.
Yeah. Which, and we'll get into the major, I guess, arguments against that. But it makes me think again of the idea of the Monty Python God, where if there's nothing else to draw on, I'm going to draw on that one image, you know? Mm-hmm. Basically, you reach the point in the argument where you have to deal with the inevitability of mental images. It's just hard to ignore that this is one of the points that Van Drunen makes in this, is like it's just something that happens automatically. It's that gut instinct imagining of the Monty Python God again. And so critics of this have argued that if mental images are inevitable, well, then that means visual images are perhaps permissible as well. Like people are, which I think that I can understand that argument. It's like people are going to imagine what Christ looks like. And if we don't give them some guidance, then you know, they're going to cling to something or another, you know, which I feel like is kind of the case with these images of the Judeo-Christian God, where it's like, you didn't give me anything to picture, so I'm only going to picture the Sistine Chapel. I'm only going to picture a Stephen Colbert skit or the Monty Python depiction of the Almighty. But then Van Drunen points out that it has gone in the opposite direction as well. People saying, well, if visual images are not allowed, then we cannot have mental images either. Why on earth would we allow, would we say no visual images if we're going to still let people have mental images? Though again, how do you enforce that?
Oh, this kind of reminds me of some of the teachings of Christ about how to obey the Torah. And I think this was something that was taught by other rabbis as well, that you have heard thou shalt not commit murder. But in fact, if you're angry with someone, you've committed murder in your heart. So it's like, not only don't do it physically, don't even go there mentally, which I think you could look at that multiple ways. But one way to look at it is that's a sort of like extra safety valve, right? It's like if you can't even go that far, then you're not even going to get close to committing a physical murder.
I can definitely see the connective tissue between those two concepts. which ultimately, I guess this is something that you get at in any of these religious traditions. It's like there's the external world of symbols and imagery and literature and so forth, but then there's inevitably the inner experience as well, and you know, the two are connected, but there are also these walls between them. And at various points in history, people have really gotten caught up on that inner world, like how to, ultimately that's where we all are. Like that's where all the main battles are taking place, right? That's where you're trying to enter some sort of meditative state. That's where you're trying to obtain peace.
So I think it's interesting to note that there have been strong trends, not just of aniconism, but sometimes of pronounced actual anti-iconism in all three of the major Abrahamic religions. And remember, in the first episode, we made the distinction there. Just because a religion is largely aniconic, say they don't use figural representations of the divine presence, doesn't mean they're necessarily anti-iconic. It wouldn't necessarily imply that they think figural representations are bad, though sometimes in some religions the figural representations are prohibited or are preached against.
Yeah, and in this we really get into the subject of iconoclasm and iconoclasts, which we touched on already, I believe. But all of this is very much tied to the discussion of aniconism. Now, a lot of you've probably heard various artists and thinkers referred to broadly as iconoclasts. I say, unfortunately, like that's the thing that comes to my mind first, instead of like examples from Byzantine history. It's more, various Rolling Stone headlines. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I did a search for iconoclast on Rolling Stone's website.
Okay.
And here are just a few of the people that come up being described as iconoclasts or being mentioned in articles where the word iconoclast is used.
Oh, boy.
So Anthony Bourdain, Noel Gallagher, Justin Thoreau, golfer David Ferret. I believe that's Ferret. Sure. I don't know this golfer.
Don't either.
Lady Gaga, Tom Petty, Chance the Rapper, Frank Zappa, Amy Winehouse, Iggy Pop, Bjork, George Romero, Slipknot.
Slipknot, yes.
Slipknot, Maybelline, yes. So just to name a few. Now, I should say, like, this is all perfectly fair because iconoclast has come to mean anyone who attacks or breaks down cherished beliefs or institutions. You know, someone who says, you might think rock and roll is this, but it's actually this.
It's often synonymous with rebel or contrarian, maybe.
Yeah. And there's sometimes I think where it's an overstatement of an artist's contribution, but I don't know. It's ultimately all fair in the game of like rock and roll PR, right?
Mm-hmm.
But more specifically, an iconoclast is a supporter of the 8th and 9th century movements in the Byzantine church who sought to abolish the veneration of icons and other religious imagery. But we see iconoclasms in plenty of other religions as well. And I think this might be, you know, the better way to think about an iconism in a way, you know, outburst movements and crisis points in an iconism that leave lasting effects on the culture. We can see examples of this, of iconoclasm in ancient Egypt, for instance.
Oh, okay. So with like the Akhenaten movement, the push towards something like a monotheism way in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, with the sun disk and Atenism and so forth.
Yeah,
the shift to that, and then the subsequent return to the familiar Egyptian pantheon. Both shifts involved iconoclasm. Now, and as far as Islam is concerned, first let's just provide a brief overview of the importance of an iconism in Islam, as outlined in the Hadith, a collection of traditions containing sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. So my main source on this is a really excellent paper, Between Cult and Culture, Bamiyan, Islamic Iconoclasm and the Museum, by Finbar Barry Flood of NYU, an expert in Islamic art, and it was published in the Art Bulletin in 2002. So Flood points out that the two main arguments against figuration in the prescriptive texts are that we should not usurp divine creative power, and that we should avoid polytheism and idolatry. And in both of these, Flood writes, there's a strong concern with the materialistic worship found in non-Islamic traditions at the time. He also points out that this was also a common move among both Christians and Jews as well in considering the religion of others. Like, look to what other faiths are doing and interpret it as polytheism.
Yes. This reminds me of things I remember encountering in my childhood in Tennessee, where conservative Protestants would accuse Catholics of being polytheists.
Right. Yeah. I think that that's very much an example of this sort of thing. Now, the general consensus in the Hadith, Flood writes, is that one should not depict anything that has a shadow. Thus, we see this rich artistic history that depends instead on abstraction, geometry, and script. Coinage, for example, that depends on script, not figures. But here's the really important take-home from Flood. While Western commentators often fall into this trap, you can't look to moments of iconoclasm by particular sects or actors, such as the destruction of the Buddhas at Bamiyan by the Taliban in Afghanistan, as evidence of a fixed, sweeping, and essential example of broad Islamic culture. Instead, we're looking at a great deal of variation, complexity, and sophistication in the Muslim response to images, which entail varying attitudes over time and space. And he points out that, you know, there's a lot to gain from looking at iconoclastic moments in Islamic history, but you can't classify them all under a single rubric for iconoclasm, no more than you can do it for Christian iconoclasm by looking at these moments. Because you do see, you know, the issues shift around a bit in Islamic history. So Flood points out that the Umayyad Caliphate established an enduring precedent for an iconic coins in 697. But, quote, even after this date, however, variations in attitudes to figuration existed for some later Islamic rulers issued coins bearing figural imagery. He also points out that you find Islamic palaces that were lavishly decorated with sculpture and paintings that had anthropomorphic elements that were in stark contrast to religious architecture of the same period. So especially during the 7th century, you would find this divide between the way secular and religious buildings were designed and decorated.
Oh, okay. So there could also be a distinction there between religious art and secular art within Islamic cultures.
Right. And for instance, just in the secular arts, he mentions that anthropomorphic and zoomorphic images proliferated in that realm. Again, the secular world outside of the religious sphere. And that ultimately, attitudes, quote, carried from individual to individual and could change over time or with the advent of new political regimes with different cultural values. And that's one of those statements that I think it may seem like an overstatement of the obvious, but oftentimes outside of the Islamic world, it's easy to just like look at it as a monolith and not acknowledge that reality. Now, this gets interesting as well. There were sometimes workarounds, such as the recontextualization of a particular text or work, or decapitation. An item or work, be it 2D or 3D, no distinction was apparently made, it might remain untarnished, unaltered, undestroyed, if context showed that it wasn't being venerated, or if you removed the head or the face from the work, thus making it inanimate and devoid of a soul, Flood writes. Hmm. And this is interesting because, you know, I think outside observers, they might tend to just immediately think of like, okay, the decapitation or the defacement is like a severe example of iconoclasm. But as Flood points out, they're actually, quote, a type of instrumental iconoclasm, as it permitted the rest of the work to survive in an altered form. It's ultimately a creative strategy. So if you have an illuminated text, with illustrations, and the text is valuable knowledge, do you destroy the whole text? Or do you rip out the pages that have illustrations, or do you just deface the images? And therefore, the majority of the text remains, but it has been brought, into the realm where it's going to be accepted by those that would be critical of its use of imagery. So you get into these various scenarios when you get outside, increasingly outside of the religious world, and you get more into the secular world. But avoidance of divine images in Islam, Flood writes, was pretty much universal. And I've got one more quote I want to read from Flood here. Quote, there is no evidence to suggest that the divine image was represented in the Islamic world, despite occasional tendencies towards anthropomorphism. But in the Eastern Islamic world, depictions of the Prophet Muhammad survive from the 13th century on. In later paintings, the Prophet is sometimes, but not always, portrayed with his face veiled or otherwise obscured. This reticence about the face finds a counterpart in the activities of medieval iconoclasts in the Islamic world.
Okay, so that would go along with the depictions of secular artwork that we were talking about. That say if you the artist might think that if you obscure the face of the prophet, you're not inviting anyone to view him as divine.
Yes, but I, again, I think it's important to drive home that in this example, and really all the examples we've been discussing here, is that it's more a story of different movements of an iconism, outbursts of an iconism, and the ebb and flow across, you know, the centuries or longer.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Summon your anticipation for an all-new season of our favorite Netflix series, Bridgerton. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? And meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. And I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix May 16th. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop starting May 2nd.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, I've been having a thought as we've been looking at a lot of these examples about a general trend of a common back and forth. I wonder to what extent this is true, that I also want to be careful not to just like gut feel my way into overgeneralizations. But I kind of wonder if there is often in religion a general trend toward more iconic artistic representations of religious subjects, as there is increased emphasis on familiarity and relationship in the religious practice, you know, the familiarity between the god and the worshiper. And then there's a backlash that goes against iconism when there's sort of a return to purity movement that emphasizes something less individual, less relational, and more abstract.
Yeah, yeah. I can see where that could certainly be a part of it. I mean, there's also a frequent trend is like, what do you make these images out of? You know, mm-hmm. you're making them, you know, they're fine works of art, they're material possessions. So I feel like there's the material and the rebellion against the material world that takes place in all of this as well, again, across various cultures.
Now, almost everything we've talked about so far has been in the context of religion, but of course, some of these same ideas about iconic representation versus aniconism could be applied outside the context of religion.
Yeah, I was thinking, for instance, about the Muppet Babies. You remember? Did you ever watch the Muppet Babies, Joe?
Oh yeah, I did. I remember. Yeah.
Well, remember we never saw the nanny's face, right?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, we did see legs. Does that count? I guess that's part of the spectrum, right? We talked about the spectrum in the last episode. That the just seeing the legs and the sneakers and the striped socks does seem less figural than showing the whole body.
Yeah, she is kind of the goddess of the Muppet Babies, mm-hmm. and we never see her face. What does it mean? Is she like a god? Can we not imagine what her face is? Can they not see her face because they have their vision's not good enough, you know, 'cause she's pretty tall. but this also made me think of various franchises where there are particular types of franchises, like the Star Wars sort of franchise, where it's been created, it's been, you know, embellished and built upon, and then you end up with a certain set of guidelines, usually internal guidelines for what can and cannot be done within this fictional universe. Mm-hmm. Like the main example that comes to mind is the long-standing mandate that you're not supposed to give a name to the species of Yoda. You know, that Yoda's Yoda, and you just can't talk about like what he is or where he comes from. And a large part of that is like you want some sort of mystery in your expansive world. If you don't have mysterious gaps in it, it will all feel too small.
I just feel sure that somebody has broken that rule at some point. There's got to be like an expanded universe novel that said what species Yoda was. They went to the Yoda planet. Am I wrong?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible. I would like to hear more about it if that's the case. But I feel like it was pretty strongly enforced or at least honored by people who were playing in the Lucas sandbox. But it made me wonder. Okay, well, what about, you know, what else is there, say, within the Star Wars world? I guess there's the Clone Wars. When after the first trilogy came out, Lucas knew that he wanted to do something with the Clone Wars eventually. So there was a prohibition against prequel matters because he knew he wanted to do his own prequel. Mm-hmm. But it made me think about visual depictions. Like, and again, this would largely be a matter of like internal mandates and, internal statements about what can and cannot be depicted. But I wonder if there are any, large-ish fictional universes where there is some sort of prohibition against visualizing certain characters or entities.
Hmm.
The only possible example that came to mind, I was thinking about this, and again, I have no access to internal documents, so this is all just me guessing. But I know in the...
Okay.
The Warhammer 40,000 universe, I don't think you ever see depictions of the chaos gods that are trying to bring about the ruination of the galaxy. And I wonder how much of that is there being a mandate that says, hey, you shouldn't actually illustrate what these things look like, or is it just simply a matter of like professional artists working within that realm and being inspired by a legacy of artists working in the weird and the dark, if they just instinctively know that, okay, if you have some sort of dark elder god, if you actually draw it, you will diminish it in some fashion. And it needs to be this sort of big, scary concept as opposed to something that fits on a single page.
I've got one.
What's that?
Never see Dr. Claw, do you? Or you never see his face?
Oh, that's right.
It's just the glove.
Not in the actual series. I mean, I'm sure they broke this rule in the live action films, but yeah, in the old cartoon, he was, you never saw his face, just that clawed hand, and you saw his cat, right?
Right, though apparently at some point there was an action figure, because ultimately the purpose of every cartoon is to sell toys. And so you got to have action figures. And what would have been great is if the action figure had just been an optical illusion. It's like a chair with an arm from no matter what angle you look at it. I would have given them credit on that. But no, there is an action figure that's just, he's plastic. He's just got gray hair and he looks angry and he's wearing a black jacket. Can you look this up and find it?
I will look it up, but while I'm looking it up, I think you've really touched upon, you've basically answered the question. Like all these things I've mentioned, Star Wars, Warhammer, even Muppet Babies, I guess, you know, these are all about creating icons, mass producing icons and selling them to children, you know? So if there is an iconism within Star Wars, that's to its detriment, because that's one less thing that you can make into a figure and then sell to somebody.
But I got to have you look it up, Rob. Put this stuff in your head.
Oh, now the first thing that comes up is the toy, but its face is obscured. So, I mean, as part of the packaging, like the original packaging, you would have to buy him to see what his face looked like.
Oh, that's a good gimmick, but yeah, I still
don't
like it.
I've
got
to find another image. Okay, here it is. Now I see it. Yeah, that's not Dr. Claw. That's not him.
Why does he have such big teeth?
Yeah,
he has like, he's gritting his teeth and his mouth is open, like his lips are open very wide, but his teeth are clenched together.
Yeah, that's not my Dr. Claw.
What does his hair look like? Who else has that three spiked hair? Is that like Goku hair?
I'm looking at kind of a thumbnail of it, but I get strong David Lynch and David Cronenberg vibes. You know, that like kind of white impressive hair that kind of sticks up. But still, he looks angrier than either of those two individuals. So I really don't know what to make of this Dr. Claw here.
Also, huge belt, a gigantic belt buckle that's as big as his face. Oh, not quite as big, but that's a big buckle.
Did we ever see what Cobra Commander looked like on the old G.I. Joe cartoons? Seems like that might have been another area where you were not permitted to see like what was under the mask. You just had to imagine it.
Oh, well, this actually does. This connects to an area that I know you know well. I wonder if masked characters and the desire to keep the mask on, obviously they're still anthropomorphic because they're in their bodies. I mean, they're pretty much fully embodied, but the hiding of the face does in a way seem maybe lightly analogous to a type of light aniconism. You know, it's obscuring one of the most important parts of the human figure.
Yeah, so if you can never see Cobra Commander's face, like you can never see him as a full human, you know, like he's always going to retain a certain mystique and inhumanity.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's all I have. Not really much in the way of answers on that, on all of that, but just sort of questions. And then I guess that's kind of the truth on pretty much every example of an iconism that we've discussed here, is like it ultimately raises more questions than we have real answers to, and just kind of makes you think and ponder like our relationship with images.
Yeah, this is one where I've really enjoyed this pair of episodes. We got into a lot of interesting history and religious art and stuff, but I do feel like I've kind of failed to find like a good way to frame this in a psychological or neuroscientific theory. So I don't know, maybe listeners could help us out with that. What does this bring to mind for you in those worlds?
Yeah, we're a bit like Brother William at the end of The Name of the Rose, where we feel like that, you know, these ladders that we've built and used and inherited have failed us in arriving at the truth. We have, when the library is burned, and we just have to walk away from it.
Well, let's not die wedged in that secret passageway.
No. All right. Yeah. So once again, we'd love to hear from everybody out there, your thoughts on, you know, especially, you know, any kind of an iconism that you have grown up in or, you know, have a cultural connection to. I'd love to hear from you on that. Certainly anything in the art world is fair game. Write in. Let us know. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.